Nuremberg, Germany is an old, old medieval city, a free city going back just hundreds and hundreds of years, where Albrecht Dürer lived and worked. And we lived in Nuremberg, I guess, and in this town named Fürth, which is just really an outskirts of Nuremberg City. Nuremberg had a famous Christmas market, and I suppose, like some of those markets, it went back to medieval times. It was called the Kris Kringle Market, and we're pretty certain it still goes on every Christmas, even now, and have even kicked around the idea sometimes of going back to visit and see it. It was quite a treat, and big, with food, entertainment, and all kinds of booths and folk art and commercial stuff, and it was fun. Anyway, there's a kind of a long story with involved about really Cindy and her first big Christmas in Germany, which we're talking about now, 1955, I guess, and the Kris Kringle Market and a decoration and so forth. Margot's going to tell that story.
Well, that before that Christmas, I bought Cindy a little book about Christmas, and I don't remember anything about that book except that it had the phrase gaily colored decorations and another phrase, the angel on the very tip top. And this was describing the tree in the book. And Cindy loved those expressions. And she talked about gaily colored decorations for, I don't know, forever. And nothing would do but that we had an angel for the very tip top of the tree. Well, we did not have an angel for the very tip top of the tree. So Quentin and I decided that we would take Cindy and go to the Kris Kringle Market and see if we could find such a thing for her, because it seemed so important to her. And so that's what we did one Saturday. We packed Cindy up and went off to the Kris Kringle Market. We had a wonderful time. She just loved it there, and so did we. And we did indeed find an angel for the very tip top of the tree. Cindy still has the angel and uses it on her tree every Christmas. And this year she said was going to be the last year for the angel. She's going to retire it. And so we thought we should record this story while we were thinking about all these wonderful things. And
wasn't that, though, I'm not sure it is the end, isn't that, didn't you have those things up in the closet and
I got the balls out, the Christmas balls and other things that we put on the tree. And because Cindy wanted to see them. So I got them out for her and I showed them to her, and then I put them up on the top of a closet shelf that was the entranceway into our house. And she insisted every day when Quentin got home from work, because I told her I couldn't reach them, they were too high. And so every day when her dad got home from work, she made him take the gaily colored decorations out of the closet so she could look at them. We never put our tree up in those days until Christmas Eve. That was the day the tree went up. And so she could only look at the decorations in the boxes up until Christmas Eve because we didn't have a tree.
Is that the year I was given a watch for Christmas, the Rolex?
I don't know whether it was that year or not, but I did buy you a watch for Christmas, and I had to take her with me to buy the watch because I didn't have anyone to leave her with. And so I told her this was a secret. And I explained secrets to her and told her she must not tell you about this watch. So I made the mistake of putting the watch up in the closet near the gaily colored decorations, and she saw me do that. So when you went up to get the gaily colored decorations down, she said, "Get the watch down too, Dad."
Our first Christmas together was Christmas 1951. I had returned from Korea, I don't even know when, but probably late summer or something like that. We lived in Manhattan, Kansas, and we were stung with a, as I remember, $1,200 bill that I had to repay, which is another story, and maybe we want to pursue it sometime, but my salary was seriously docked. I was making enough that we could live on, but my salary at that time was seriously cut back, so it was thin pickings, if you will, for that Christmas. Anyway, we had a good time. We lived in a basement apartment. It seems to me that we lived in the home of owned by the sheriff of, I don't know what, Manhattan, Kansas, or the police chief, I forget which, but anyway. They owned, they rented out apartments. They rented one up above them, and we lived in the basement. There was another couple of loony toonies that lived in the basement next to us. Oh, no, we were young, and we didn't give a damn about that. But anyway, we bought a tree, and there are, by the way, some photographs of this somewhere in some albums, I think. But we bought a tree, and we bought a settle, one little dinky set of lights, and some tinsel, and we had a great Christmas tree. Now, our Christmas, we didn't have a lot of money. What we did was we bought two wine glasses at like $1 a piece, and we sort of mulled this over, walked around, and said, "Oh God, can we afford, you know, $1 a glass?" That kind of thing, and a bottle of white Bordeaux wine. Now, I clearly remember how much we were paying for French, mind you, white Bordeaux wine at that time was 99 cents. You'd think winos could afford that. Anyway, that's what we had. Our Christmas 1951 together, which was a wonderful time in Manhattan, Kansas, two $1 wine glasses and a 99 cent bottle of real French Bordeaux. I must say, and this is a Christmas story I'm going to tell, I must say that my life has not been filled with wants and desires. Oddly enough, I don't go through life saying, "Oh God, I wish I had this and that." I really don't. And for instance, right now, here where I am, December 1997, I really don't have a lot of desires. I mean, you can't say, "Well, what do you really want?" And, you know what, if I really want it, I'd go out and buy it, I guess, that kind of thing. And I simply don't have any, I don't know, maybe I'm so wishy-washy or something and I don't have these great desires. And I look back at my childhood, and I can't remember, first off, let me stop a minute. I don't have a lot of memories about Christmas. I just simply don't. They're very, very mushy in my head. I told the story about the harmonica, but there was another story that I do remember that I want to tell here. About two blocks from where we lived in a place called Wilkerson Avenue in Jersey City, and we were like, I think everybody was poor there, I suppose. Extremely Irish neighborhood, mostly. But about two or three blocks away, on the corner, I can see, you know, I have this visual memory and I can still see this store. Was, I would describe it as an electric store. I think they sold light fixtures and maybe small appliances, toasters and radios, something like that, in this store on the corner. They had in the window of this store an electric train. I guess they sold electric trains. But anyway, they had off to, I can still see this electric train. They had in the window this incredibly beautiful, heavy, die-cast, like Lionel train, which I suppose was somewhere between 9 and 12 inches maybe long. It was painted in official olive drab work color. And what it was it was a work train. This long thing where you could haul around railroad ties and pieces of rail. It had a little kind of cabin on it, maybe a motor, I don't remember. And what it had also was a derrick. And the derrick had two little wheels you could kind of turn, and one wheel would raise a derrick or lower it, and one wheel would turn the derrick left or right so you could sort of unload railroad ties or whatever you had. Now, I remember seeing this train, this little one car. It was one car of a train, not a whole train. And it wasn't set up like a train. It was just like this train on maybe a single piece of track. You know, when Lionel trains had three rails, maybe still do, I guess. I remember thinking, I want this thing, this train, this one car, this incredible thing with the derrick that went up and down around them. More than anything I wanted in the whole world, I wanted this. And I knew, as a kid, I suppose, that this was an impossible dream. I'm not sure before tonight, on this very tape, that I've ever told the story to anyone. Now, maybe I can check with Margaret. Maybe I've told her the story. I don't remember if I did, but certainly I haven't told it to many people. But I wanted this car, this train. I knew that if I had it, I would be perfectly happy for the rest of my life, or at least for some time in my life. And I knew it was absolutely out of the question to get. And I don't think I ever mentioned anybody, and it's, I don't know, it's almost a poignant story, I suppose, that I think, a sad story. In some European countries, at least years ago, and maybe even now, and in some big cities, like in New York City, once in a while, you'll see where a traffic cop will station himself outside on a busy, like, intersection or whatever, traffic going right and to the left and whatever, and so forth, and he'll direct traffic, superseding the stoplight. You don't see it much. It's probably quite rare. I'd be surprised if many listeners have seen this, and I suppose in many cases it's not done much. I've seen it in Europe and Germany and for instance in Japan. But anyway, my little story is really a Christmas story about Germany. In Nuremberg, they had a few places where there were policemen who were the major directors of traffic on in main intersections, and they would direct the traffic left and right. And it's kind of fun to sometimes watch these policemen, or it was, because you know, they had whistles and they had little dances they did, and often wore white gloves and did little pirouettes and those sort of things. It's sort of fun, and I don't know that it was just an old thing to do. I don't know that you see them much anymore. But in Nuremberg at Christmas time, there were a couple of famous intersections where the left right traffic, like traffic circles, were controlled by these policemen who were in a kind of kiosk in the center of the road, sort of surrounded maybe by a little a platform, if you will, and maybe a balustrade and a light or whatever, and his white gloves, and he's high above and he's blowing his whistle left and right. But at Christmas time, if you would go, when we were there, I think maybe I only saw this once or twice, but by late evening, people, the commuters of Nuremberg, they would leave presents for this traffic cop who they see, you know, you'd see 5 days a week or 6 days a week when you drove to work, wouldn't know his name or wouldn't really even know him much, except, you know, you would recognize the tall fella in the cap is there all the time. But they left presents, and by the end of the day, by dusk, this policeman would be absolutely inundated with presents, bottles of wine, and you know, stolen cakes, and STOLLEN, as opposed to the New York kind of stolen cakes. All kinds of little gifts and flowers and what have you. And there's really a kind of a wonderful, old-fashioned, I think, fun thing. And I wonder if they do that anymore or not. And I suppose the cops have been replaced now by stoplights or something. But it'd be fun to go back and see if that still goes on. General MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo was the Daiichi building, which means like number one. And it's right, it was opposite on the other side of the street from the Imperial Palace. And of course, we didn't bomb the Imperial Palace in World War II. And so there were some peripheral buildings around the Imperial Palace that weren't bombed. And so this building was in mint condition, I guess, and that's where General MacArthur's headquarters, that's where he had his headquarters. Anyway, he had one of these policemen, traffic cops, only he was American military policeman, out in the front of the Daiichi building, directing traffic 24 hours a day, I guess. Now, this is a true story. They changed that military policeman every hour. So there were 24 police changes. This young military policeman was out there directing traffic for 1 hour. He should be placed. Now, when he went in to his their barracks or whatever, which was in the basement of the Daiichi building, I talked to one of these fellows, by the way, and I met him. In any case, they changed their whole uniform from head to toe. They had in the basement of the Daiichi building an entire laundry set up. So these guys wore their uniforms only 1 hour. They wore their boots only 1 hour, and there were teams of Japanese youth who spent their life down there shining shoes. So their shoes were shined every hour. Their brass was shined every hour, their uniform complete. So they went out. You talk about, he looked like he stepped out of a bandbox. These guys really did step out of a bandbox. This week, they released the most expensive movie ever made in the world, is the Titanic, movie about the Titanic. We would sort of talking about it over supper. I think the date was 1907, but I wouldn't absolutely bet my life, but I think that is the date of the sinking of the Titanic. It's a famous story and everybody knows it. I must digress and say there was a funny cartoon in the paper or whatever that showed some adults and some children lining up to buy tickets for the Titanic movie. And one adult says to the other adult, "Well, I guess the iceberg scene where the boat sinks is just absolutely incredible drama. And the two little kids behind him are saying, "Well, thanks a lot for ruining the movie." And I'm sure that is true. But why I mention the Titanic is we knew their names were O'Neill. They were Irish. They were from Ireland. I don't know where in Ireland. But they were on the Titanic when it sank. They were in steerage. In other words, they were down below decks, and you know, there were first, second class passengers, and then there was all the peons in steerage, and that's where they were. They escaped, both of them escaped and lived to tell a story, if you will. And I remember just a fragment of this story. I'm not sure I ever heard the whole story, but I remember a fragment of it. Is that they went up on deck, and she found a knife, like a pocket knife, saw a pocket knife on the deck, okay? She picked the pocket knife up for whatever reason, finders, keepers, losers, weepers, I guess, but in any case, they got into a lifeboat, and the lifeboat, the rope got hung up on one end, and they were sort of dangling this lifeboat with, they couldn't launch it because they couldn't get this rope away. And of course, you know the story is she produced this jackknife she found and cut the rope, and the lifeboat got away, and it saved everybody's life on that lifeboat. And a rather dramatic story. I guess the last surviving member of the Titanic, and it was a young girl, she was like 7 at the time, something like that. She is she died, so there's no survivors of the Titanic. One other thing about the Titanic that I found startling, and it just is glued in my head. And the question is, what was the first class fare on the Titanic on the day it sunk? What did you pay to be a first class passenger? The number is so high, so astronomically high, I don't want to believe it, except I know it was printed in Newsweek, and they know I didn't see a retract and say, "Oh, we moved the decimal point or whatever." So that question is, what was the fare of first class passenger? Well, I'll tell you what it was. It was $50,000. Do you know how much money that was in like 1907? $50,000 to ride first class in the Titanic. It's just a staggering amount of money. And that was before, you know, income tax and the like. Quick quiz. The sister ship of the Titanic also sank. They don't know why it sank. It either hit a mine or it was torpedoed by a German submarine. The year was, well, it was during World War I. They just located the wreck, I think, just this very year. Your quiz is, what is the name of the sister ship to the Titanic? I think maybe rural societies and primitive societies and pre-literate societies and European societies had all kinds of sayings and proverbs and the like. For instance, Africa is just, Africa is a wealth of wonderful proverbs and sayings, and sometimes they're illustrated in the arts and whatever. I think these are dying out. I'd be surprised if I could ask Emma or Ethan even, let's say, "Hey, tell me some of these one-line zingers that, you know, pride goeth before a fall," or something like that. I'd be surprised if they could come up with many, although I think I was raised in a world where these were just common, and people said them, and they're kernels of truth or whatever. Sometimes, I don't know, you can't do much with them. Don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes, I suppose, might be one. And I don't know what to do with that. I mean, I don't have a gun even, and you certainly don't want to fire whether I see the whites of somebody's eyes or not. But there are other ones that are valuable, and quotations of famous people on the same thing. And of course, Shakespeare, if you read Shakespeare, he's got one or two of these on every page. So maybe not that many. But in any case, I want to tell you one, I want to share one with my listeners that I think is a great truth, if you will. It was said apparently in 1932 by Calvin Coolidge, of all people, and you know, he's little quoted and not remembered very well. But in any case, he said this, and I think there's a great truth in this, okay? Quote, "Nothing takes the place of persistence," unquote. Then he said at the same time, in the same speech or whatever, quote, "Press on," unquote. I think this is really important. I don't think it necessarily characterizes me, but I think this is absolutely true. Persistence is, it's really important to be persistent, to hang in there, keep going, press on. I think old Cal had a point. Before, by the way, we tape anything at night, or we do it sometimes at lunch even, or whenever the mood takes us, we always sort of play back the last thing we taped. I just played this proverb, famous saying business. I want to go out on a limb and say the very best line in Shakespeare, as far as the things I'm talking about, maybe not the most beautiful line, but the line that has the most, potentially the most meaning, I think, is his famous line. To thy own self be true. I think that's Shakespeare was never better than that. And then I think there's another line that I like, and it's Frost, and he says there's something like in his poem, there's worse things to be than a swinger of birches. Worse things to be than a swinger of birches. And I think that's really a wonderful line. If, by the way, you say, "Oh, gee, I don't agree with Quentin on that," I invite you somehow to put forth the one-line zinger that you think is better than the ones I said. Back to Christmas stories. Midnight masses in cities that I grew up in the East were common, I think. Often the church had a midnight mass held that late, and people went to it, often families went to it. And in the case of Margo was telling me about this, her family used to go to midnight mass. And then they would go home, and they would, at least sometimes, they would have Christmas presents. And this has to be like, what, 2 o'clock in the morning or something? But interesting midnight mass. And I can remember attending at least one. Now, I don't know how many I've attended, but as a child, I remember living in Brooklyn and attending one night with my mother. So they're interesting. We looked in the paper here in Ellensburg just for fun to see if anybody at all had midnight services, And the answer is no. There was a one church, not the Catholics, had a 10 o'clock service or some hymns or something. The Catholic Church has no midnight mass here in town. Now, whether the practice has died out or... I suspect it hasn't. I bet if you go to big cities or bigger cities in Ellensburg, you'll find it. Although Ellensburg is a rather Catholic... I think of it as a rather Catholic town. And Washington has, as many people know, Washington State has a lot of Catholics, although I think it is known to be the least churched state in the, one of the worst church states in the nation. Now, Margo wants to say something desperately here.
No, all I want to say is I looked in the paper, the Yakima paper, there are no churches in Yakima having any midnight.
Oh, is that right?
Either. And Yakima has a big cathedral.
Yeah.
For a bishop.
They have a bishop there, don't they?
And there is no midnight service in Yakima either. I do not agree with your statement.
Which is?
That midnight services exist in large cities. I do not think they exist anymore at all.
You think people are afraid to go out at night? Or
yes.
Just
I
practice,
think that...
Practices change? Or?
I think it started out as a fear of being harmed on the way to or from church.
Did I too quickly summarize your experience as when you were a child going to midnight mass and the family going back and be sometimes having opening presents?
So always we opened presents after midnight mass, yes.
Yeah.
And we went every single year. I couldn't tell you how many times.
Is that right? Do you remember
times.
Going with your father and mother? Or?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The whole family went.
Is that
we
right?
did not sit together because we all had something to do. My father was an usher.
Uh-huh.
I was in the choir. My mother had something
she
to do.
She was in the Altar
Society. There was always something that each one of us, something that each one of us had to do.
Yes.
But we went together, and we met together after Mass,
uh-huh.
and came home together.
I'll be darned. That's a great story. Well, I just checked the tape, and it's almost finished. These are one-hour tapes. And I just want to finish this tape off by recording as an official Fitzgerald position is the greatest Christmas carol is Good King Wenceslaus. And everything else runs second to that, including that off-played and overdone Messiah, which is, I want to have a moratorium on the Messiah for 5 or 10 years, and we never hear it.